Okay, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. And if you've lived in Utah or anywhere in the West for a length of time, you've probably heard about or known somebody who's sort of up and disappeared. Maybe they were a little bit rebellious. Maybe they were out carousing on Saturday night, and they went to one of the numerous ranches or disciplinary areas, or the most famous being the Utah Boys Ranch down in the desert for some, R&R to get them back in line. Tonight we're going to talk a little bit about the Boys Ranch and what our guest Eric Norwood terms the Mormon Gulag. Eric, well, welcome to Mormon Expression.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
And we brought a friend of yours who's also been through the Boys Ranch system, Cade. Hey, Cade.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing great. Well, Eric, why don't you start us off and give us a little background about yourself?
Sure. I was at the Utah Boys Ranch in... I actually got there on Valentine's Day in the year 2000, and I was there until I turned 18 on October 24th, 2002. So about, almost, 3 years. And I'm 26 now, and I started the website MormonGulag.com, and that's about, that's it.
All right, welcome. Now, and Cade, maybe your background.
Yeah, and I don't really recall the specific dates, but I was there for 7 months, and it was from 2001 to 2002. Actually, no, I apologize. It was from 2000, just during 2000, and I went there, and I'm 27 now. I grew up here in Salt Lake, and so for me, heading out there was not really, for some of the people around me, it was different because they had been shipped from all over different parts of the states or even, internationally. So for me, it wasn't as much of a shocker, but it was definitely a shocker. And now I'm living in, Salt Lake City, Utah, and moving on.
All right, great. Why don't we start at the beginning? So what exactly is the Utah Boys Ranch? What do they do there?
Well, it is, they call themselves a therapeutic boarding school, and they provide, they provide treatment or structure. It's kind of like a reform school. There isn't fences or anything there, like a juvenile detention center, but that they basically claim to help troubled teens, anything from kids that are depressed, kids that are doing drugs, and then there's a whole another group of kids there that are, some serious, sexual offenders. And so it's, they say they treat all sorts of stuff there. And it's kind of a weird place. It's a facility. It doesn't look at all like a ranch or anything like that. It's a bunch of buildings out in West Jordan over by the Kennecott mine. And, they do like some hardcore forced labor, like disciplinary stuff. And then they have a lot of Mormon doctrine there at the same time. That's why I called it a Mormon gulag, because it's like, there's like the hardcore part of it when you first get there and you're on the work crew. And then the first people that you talk to are these elderly missionaries that are super nice and way friendly. And so it's kind of a weird contrast of, feelings that you go through while you're there. And, and you're just there and you live. It's when me and Cade were there, it was just boys. There were no girls there. I guess there's girls there now. But you live there in these dorms and you wear uniforms, and it's kind of weird.
So now you're describing individuals, like sexual perpetrators or, people who've had trouble with the law, but this isn't like a state-run facility, right?
No. I would say 95% of the kids there have never been in trouble with the law. I wasn't in trouble at all with the law. It's very few number of kids that get sent there by the courts. It's mostly just like... That's a lot of just families that have problems with their kids that can either afford it, or a lot of the times the church pays for it. And they, you know, it's just normal kids, really. It's not, no one there is really a criminal. There's a few, there's probably like a 10% of the population there are some sex offenders. And besides that, there's just normal kids, just rebellious kids mostly.
So it's generally the parents and or under the direction of the church that are sending them out. This isn't like your probation officer makes you go or anything.
No, in my situation, I was getting in trouble at home, and we were meeting with the stake president of our, you know, stake back in California, and he recommended the Utah Boys Ranch, and my parents sent me there. That's how it happened. And he knew about it because another boy in our stake had gone there previously.
Yeah, there's not really anybody that goes there that is not affiliated with the LDS Church in some way.
And that's usually how they get referred there. So these parents are talking to their bishop and saying, oh, we're having problems with our son. And the bishop is referring them to the Boys Ranch.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that was pretty much every case, everyone that I knew, pretty much. That's how it happened.
So how do the parents even hear about the, you know, I've heard about it in the news from time to time, but, you know, how do the parents know this is a resource for them?
I don't know how, I mean, my parents knew about it from our stake president. I don't know how he knew about it or how they're getting the word out. I honestly don't know. But somehow back in California, he knew about this crazy place in Utah, and he told my parents about it, and they sent me there. But I don't know. I mean, I grew up in California. I had never heard of a Utah Boys Ranch or anything like that before they came to pick me up.
Okay, we'll come back to that church connection, which we obviously want to explore at some length. But let's talk about life sort of in the Boys Ranch. So Eric, you were there for 3 years?
Almost.
Maybe describe a typical day at the Utah Boys Ranch.
Oh, man. Well, when you first get there, I mean, it depends, really. There's like there's this caste system. There's, you know, like a hierarchy. And if, you know, you're at the bottom of the hierarchy, which is called the work crew, where you're just pretty much working or standing and facing a wall, just standing there, you know, for hours, you know, that would be different than if you were at the top of, you know, the caste system and wore like a blue shirt where you can at least talk and, you know, go to school and stuff. It was different. It was weird, but you'd wake up early, you'd come out, read some scriptures, pray, go back and do chores, and then, you know, go down to this cafeteria. You know, it was, I don't even know how to, you know, describe it. It's so weird, you know, talking about it. It's just, it's kind of like a military school, but you're around normal people and and Mormon guys, you know, it's not military at all. It's kind of weird. And the people that work there, they look like your bishop and every Mormon guy that you've seen, you know, everyone kind of looks, you know, normal. It's just kind of weird, but, I don't know.
So
yeah, and when I say that there are, you don't really go there unless you have Mormon ties, you also don't work there unless you have Mormon ties. Everyone employed there is LDS. All the kids who go there, like me, for example, I did not want to participate in really anything that had anything to do with the LDS religion. And they did have, or offer, I should say, a Bible studies class. But you were not allowed to take the Bible studies class if you had been baptized when I was 8. So I'd been baptized, decided I didn't want to be a member. And by the time I went there, I was 17 and I was not allowed any choice. I was made to study the LDS religion, and that was everybody who was there. Nobody went to the Bible studies class.
Yeah. So we would, you know, we would go to these classes during the day and go to seminary, and throughout the day, they would have like missionaries. There was four missionaries when we were there. I think there's more now. And they would come and take you in their office for one class period, usually. And it was called like a missionary session. And you would go in their office and watch a movie, and they would have these little lessons planned for us. And we all liked it because they had candy, and it was the only time we ever got candy. And so it was kind of weird. And so we'd go to class, and you would meet with a missionary, and then when class was over, you would go back to your, you know, your group home, and you kind of just, you know, you're living in this group home, and, you know, there's no fences or anything, but all the doors and stuff are alarmed, and your rooms are alarmed, and they have security guards that walk around at night and make sure you're in your bed. So you really can't leave, even though it looks like, you know, it, you know, if you saw a picture of the campus, it looks like if you wanted to run away, you could just run away, but you definitely can't.
So as a juvenile, I mean, you're still a ward of your parents. And does that remain in effect, or how does that whole thing work?
They sign over a power of attorney when you first get there. And, but really, like, I mean, legally, if your parents want to take you out of that place, they can. But they basically, I mean, you don't get to talk to your parents. I mean, I think it was like 3 months before I even got to talk to my parents on the phone when I was there. So they really limit any contact that you have with your parents. When you get there, and I mean, basically they have complete control over everything. They become your parents.
So how young are the youngest who are there?
Oh man. I mean, the youngest that I knew that was, I was there and I saw an 8-year-old kid.
Wow.
There. But normally the younger ones were about 12, you know, 12 and up. But there were like some super young kids that were there.
So how does schooling work? Do they take care of your normal schooling? Do they have a high school there, or were you getting that sort of academic engagement?
Oh, the schooling, I mean, they have teachers that come there, and you have class there on campus. But it's really quite a joke. I think Kate would agree. It's really, really inadequate education.
Yeah, absolutely. They have a kindergarten through 12th grade there, so you can essentially go there for any grade, and you could get your high school diploma there. But it is absolutely a joke.
What about it makes you say that?
All you need to do is show up, and I mean, any, I don't know, maybe it's just the system as a whole that makes it a joke, the way that everything is structured and religion is intertwined into everything. And then most of the teachers at least appear to be, you know, out to get a lot of the kids there, a lot of the youth that were there, and maybe not even a necessarily physically aggressive way, but oftentimes in a passive aggressive way. And then when you're doing homework, it's not on par with any sort of high school system, even in what would be, in my opinion, you know, a poor school system here in the U.S. a lot of times.
Yeah, they have, like, crossword puzzles. Like, you know, like in senior high school level classes, we're doing, like, crossword puzzles in English class. And it's really, like, you know, it reminds me of when you're a child actor on set, they have a tutor come. It really reminded me of that, like for long periods of time, like that kind of education. It's pretty bad.
So was the regular, you know, high school secular education separated from the religious education?
Oh, no. These were people that worked for the Boys Ranch that were the teachers. And it was not at all secular. It was the opposite of secular.
Well, not just that. There were two buildings. The seminary building was probably, I don't know, 7/8 as big as the actual school portion. Each maybe had, well, maybe the seminary had six classes and the chapel, six classrooms and a chapel. And then the school had maybe 7 or 8 classes and a gym. And so It was just all askewed as well. It wasn't like it was a huge place and there was a lot of action going on. They did all of this in such a small space that many of the things were intertwined, and it was just real, real goofy.
So about how many kids were there when you guys were there?
Oh, I'd say maybe 100, 110.
So a pretty small group then.
Yep.
And what would have been the ratio of inmates to guards?
Well, they had, in our group homes, we had three staff. They were called our home staff, and there was a married couple and then like a single, usually a return missionary, living in like a studio. He lived in the studio apartment, and the couple lived in like a one-bedroom apartment that was attached to our dorms. And so there would be three, those would be our three main staff, that were with us, 24/7, except for when we were at school. And, there'd be about, I'd say like 20, 25 of us in a home, maybe. And,
Yeah, and it would range in between about 18, and I remember maybe like 30 was the most we ever had in one of our homes when we had kids sleeping on the couches or something.
Yeah, and then there's all sorts of therapists and stuff that work with you, but there's probably less than, probably less than 50 staff there, maybe more, I don't know. But not too many.
You were well watched, we could say.
Oh yeah, constantly. We're constantly being watched.
So let's talk a little bit about the work detail. What sort of physical activities or physical labor did they have you doing?
Fantastic things. That's a great question.
Yeah. Wow. Besides like regular work, like cleaning and doing like, because there was no janitors or anything there. There's no like cleaning staff or like in a hospital you would have people cleaning. We completely maintained that entire facility. There was like one guy that was like a maintenance guy that would like fix like tractors and stuff, and but he wouldn't clean or anything. So we would do that kind of stuff. But on work crew, like we would just do like, BS type work, like moving rocks like into huge piles. Like we'd take these huge rocks, like these 10-pound rocks, and move them into these huge piles. It would take like an hour. This pile would be like 10 feet tall, and then we would have to like move it like 100 feet away. And this would take like, that would take up our whole day. That would be like a Monday, gone, moved a pile. And then
laying sod, doing like maintenance, maintaining a baseball diamond and nursery. There were all sorts of things that they would have you do, which was also like more legitimate work, as well as, certain fundraisers like the Scarecrow Festival and other things that were all, unpaid, the equivalent to unpaid child labor.
So they would...
It was hard work, too. It wasn't like easy stuff at all.
Setting up a small carnival.
So they would do this... So they sometimes just assign you guys... And apparently you knew you were just moving rocks around just to move them around. Was that a punishment or regular action?
Yeah, that was just to mess with us. That was like a punishment.
That would be a punishment. But pulling weeds and maintaining the baseball diamond and the nursery could also be like a regular time thing, not just a punishment. But depending on who you were in the hierarchy and kind of your personality, it really could be both.
Did you earn any sort of money, or did they give you anything in return?
No way.
Absolutely not.
Never.
So how would you get any sort of spending money to, be able to, buy some Twix?
We weren't allowed to have money, and there was no such thing as Twix.
Yeah, there's nothing to buy there. There's no vending machines or like an office, a little small closet office that sells, Twix and coloring books and stuff like that. There was nothing like that.
So, what sort of things do you wear? I guess I envision you guys in orange jumpsuits digging holes out in the dry lake bed,
Oh, yeah. And earlier, when Eric said that there was a hierarchy in as high as a blue shirt, there's actually one step higher than a blue shirt that is really – we always just kind of considered it junior staff, even though there's no way that's what it was. But you did have even more privilege than those who were who were a blue shirt if you were 18, but there's work crew, which is the lowest, and you would typically wear a green shirt. And if you were, you know, 3 weeks or 3 days to a week into work crew, you would oftentimes be wearing camo cargos or some jeans, but usually you'd be wearing a blanket tied with a rope and a green shirt.
Wait.
And then there was
on.
A green shirt. I'm sorry?
A blanket tied with a rope?
That's right. Sorry. I did kind of casually skip over that.
Yeah.
So you guys were talking about a caste system. This was literally you know, in the system that you would wear and mark yourselves as work crew, and everybody,
that's right,
all the other boys would know that, oh, you were work crew.
Right. Yeah.
Well, and all your time was spent with work crew. They were always a group of one to maybe three groups of boys doing different specific activities, or just being babysat in a specific location, i.e. the gym or somewhere in the seminary building, somewhere like that.
So how would you get on the work crew? What would you have to do to get the work crew assignment?
Well, when you first get there, that's what you do. You're on work crew. They take your clothes and they give you a green shirt and, like Cade was saying, a blanket. They take your pants away and they give you this big brown wool blanket, like you put under a saddle, and you like tie it around your, like wrap it around your waist like a towel, and you basically be wearing a dress and have a leash around you, and you're, you know, on work crew being held on a leash by a staff member like 24/7. And that's the lowest. And then after that, you can still be on work crew and wear pants, like camo pants or jeans. And
so you could earn your pants back through good behavior.
Yeah, you had to earn your pants back for sure.
And your shoes. Yeah, you had to earn your shoes as well. Oftentimes you just wear socks.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Working outside.
Yeah. Huh.
That's
sure.
Right.
So I guess they would take away everything from you. I mean, you wouldn't have a watch,
yeah,
or
you just, yeah, had your own. You just had your own underwear and socks, literally.
The beauty of that, when you saying that they take away everything, that's exactly right. You actually have to raise your hand and be called upon and ask in a specific way to do one of essentially any natural thing other than breathing. If you need to sneeze, you need to raise your arm. If you need to scratch yourself, you need to raise your arm and ask. And if you do otherwise, you can be made to stare in the corner. You can be made to do push-ups. You can be detained by a man 3 times to 4 times your size. Just all sorts of crazy things.
So I guess as you behaved yourself and learned to you know, do what you're told, you would earn up in privilege. So did the work crew get as much time like in school and in seminary as everybody else? Did they use that as a punishment?
No, the weird thing, which might kind of be borderline illegal for them to do, is there's no school at all while you're on work crew. So, I mean, I was on work crew for like 1 month stints, you know, oftentimes. And so I wouldn't go to school for like a whole month. And you know, you would still meet with the missionaries, that's it, and your therapist. But other than that, you were on work crew, like, all day.
And the only thing you were allowed to do besides sleep and be on work crew was read the Book of Mormon. That was the one activity you could do after, you know, school.
Yeah.
I think you were on work crew until 5 or 6 p.m., and then you'd come back to the home in which you were living in, and you would be allowed to read the scripture or go to bed.
Now, guys, I have to say, I can tolerate a lot of inhumane things, but making you read the Book of Mormon, that crosses the line.
No, after you get off of work crew and you're in a green shirt, you're not allowed to talk or anything. Like, a green shirt is still pretty bad. It's a lot better than being on work crew, but it's still pretty awful. But before you are allowed to get into a blue shirt, which everyone is trying to get into a blue shirt when they're there, because then you can talk and then you can call your parents and you know, things are a lot better for you. But in order to get into a blue shirt, you have to read First Nephi and you have to be able to pass it off to a missionary. And they sit and they ask you questions and you have to summarize it. And we all had to do it, and it was awful.
You have to memorize a certain portion of it.
Yeah, like you literally, like, I'm not exaggerating when I say they make you read the Book of Mormon. Like, it's not a joke. Like, you have to read it, you have to understand it, and it's like not a surprise that so many kids come out of there Mormon. Like, I had my own, you know, little phase of being brainwashed and totally, the only, you know, I had a full-on testimony, and it's the only time I ever really believed in the church was when I was there, and I was on work crew, and, you know, it's like, it's really intense how much they indoctrinate you there.
Well, you know, guys, I've read the book, The Manipulated Mind, which is about brainwashing and does studies, you know, out of prisoners in North Korea or whatever, and I have to say, this is right out of the manual. You know, if you want to run a prison camp, you're pretty much describing it. I don't mean to laugh. I mean, it's an unfortunate situation, but it's just so out there that it's hard to believe that it's right there. You know, in the Salt Lake Valley.
We are to the point now where we can oftentimes laugh about many of the experiences we had there.
So yeah. So, Eric, you referenced a couple times some physical punishment. What sort of physical punishments would they give for misbehavior?
Oh, they would it depends. Like, they oftentimes would just beat your ass, like, slam you on the ground and, like, really, like, mess you up. Like, it was intense. Like, it was hardcore. Like, they could get away with a lot, especially if you're on work crew, because there was only, like, two work crew staff. Sometimes there was just one. And so they could get away with a lot, and they did. And, you know, the sad thing about this whole thing, I can laugh about most of it, and a lot of it is just weird to me. But the really bad thing about my whole experience there was I saw a lot of kids just get their asses beat, like, bad by huge guys. And it was just uncalled for. It would be, you know, it wasn't because they were out of control, like, or they needed to be, like, restrained because they were going to hurt themselves or hurt anybody else or anything like that. It was just because they would mouth off or say the F word or do something wrong or just refuse to do something, and they would just get, like, messed up bad.
So did they make you do any, you know, like standing and holding a position or any sort of punishments like that?
Oh, God, yeah. Facing the wall, that's what it was. And me and Kate have probably collectively, like, spent, you know, 100 hours of our lives facing a wall and just staring at it. And that's what they would have you do. They would just have you stand there perfectly still with your nose, you know, touching the wall. And you just have to stand there and you couldn't move. It was weird.
So what?
That's pretty much what work crew was. If you weren't working, you were just standing there and facing the wall for hours at a time.
What sort of things would you have to do to get a punishment like that?
Oh, man. I mean, it could be anything. Like, if you, you know, if you talk back, like, if you're disrespectful, you know, cussing, you know, really, you would just have to do a lot of push-ups if you were caught cussing. But, I mean, work crew was, like, pretty much the hardest punishment that you could get. If you're a blue shirt, they, you know, and you did something wrong, if you, you know, got a bad grade on a test or something, they would put you back into a green shirt, and you'd have to earn your way back into a blue shirt again, and things like that, where they would take away phone calls and stuff and things like that. But, I mean, really, it was really anything. I don't know, Kay, do you remember any specific things that you'd get punished for work crew?
Yeah, you know, and I oftentimes find myself wondering about the things that it was that we had done. But a lot of times it seems like, well, and granted, there's probably a lot of the things that were actually repressed or in some way pushed out of your mind as you went through them. But I almost find myself leaning to think that a lot of times they were trivial things, stupid things about, you know, arguments about things in one of the homes or, you know, whose stuff it was, or even sometimes poking fun at each other, like some of the other kids in the home, or just different things. I find it difficult to remember exactly what it was, so it makes it even more so in my mind stand out like it would have been things that were trivial or that wouldn't really matter.
Well, yeah, I remember a lot of trivial things, and I remember like some serious things too. Like, you know, I mean, kids were, you know, there were some gay kids that would be caught having sex with each other, and they would, for that, they would be put in blankets on Work Crew. And, you know, there's kids that would get caught smoking weed there or failing a drug test.
Yeah, that's right. But sneaking cocaine in, and
yeah, there's some stuff like that going on, but mostly it was just like really trivial stuff, like stupid stuff.
Okay, you guys have mentioned the missionaries a couple times, and I've sort of let it go till now. So were these real official church missionaries, or just people sort of acting as missionaries?
Oh, no. Full-blown missionaries. Missionaries.
Yeah, let me state for the record that they were called there. That was their mission, Utah Boys Ranch.
So the Utah Boys Ranch, who owns and operates this thing? Is it its own entity? Is it a for-profit organization? Is it a not-for-profit, or do you guys know?
It's a non-profit, and they have a board of directors and an executive director who is Chris Butters. Most people know for 15 years, but I don't know who exactly owns it.
So let's talk a little bit about Chris. Chris Butters is Utah State Senator. He's on the Utah Senate for the South Jordan. Is it
West Jordan?
He is a very outspoken old cuss, and he's been a bishop 3 times. So he's connected into the church, and he's the executive director of this thing.
He was until 2005.
And did he step down, or?
Yeah, he was forced to step down. He had somebody at the Boys Ranch. There must have been some kind of coup, you know, within the ranks, because somebody reported him for using the Boys Ranch office in his Senate campaign, and so they had him step down, and he now receives a pension from them. But there's a new executive director now. But he was the executive director for like 15 years. He was the director when I was there. I met him, you know, many times.
But so as far as you know, the Utah Boys Ranch is not owned or operated by the church, at least not officially.
Well, I don't know how it could be possible that, definitely not officially. But I don't know how it could be possible that they have missionaries called to serve there. And they also have a ward. They have a bishop and a bishopric that are specifically assigned there. So I don't understand how they can do that without some type of ownership, but I'm not sure.
The ward part doesn't bother me as much because, you know, there's a lot of wards on post, you know, for army bases and just basically wherever they can get wards, they put wards. The missionary thing is a little strange. I'm trying to rack my brain and think of anything else that is that explicit, because this is their only duty, right? They don't do anything else.
No, it's not like they're local missionaries like in West Jordan, you know, that come by. These are elderly couples, and they're the senior missionaries, and they have offices there, and they're there 7 days a week. They don't live there, but they're there in the morning until about 5 every day.
And what is their job? What are they supposed to be doing?
Giving us the discussions and, meeting with us. They meet. I mean, you'd have a missionary session usually a couple times a week where you would go and sit with them for 45 minutes and they'd give you a lesson. It was kind of like home teaching in a way, I guess, but different. I don't know. I remember watching a lot of videos, church videos and stuff like that.
So they would spend their day meeting with boy after boy after boy and have like a almost like a therapist, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Did they have on staff any sort of social workers or psychologists or therapists or anybody serving in that role?
They did. They had every group home had its own therapist. So every, 20 boys or so, there would be a different therapist that would basically make all the decisions about, your life there.
you know. They were basically the warden. Whoever your therapist was basically the warden for you. And they ultimately determined when you got to go home. So, but there was no one from the state there ever. I was there for almost 3 years, and there's never anyone that I met from the state that came in and talked to us. These were all employees of the Boys Ranch.
So did these missionaries exert any kind of ecclesiastical control? Like, did they interview you about, you know, intimate details, or just really sort of like home teachers?
That was mostly they didn't call it a bishopric there. They called it the branch presidency. And that was basically what the branch presidency did, besides your therapist also. The branch presidency, who really kind of, the one that was there when I was there, I can't remember his name, but he reminded me a lot of Mr. Garrison, and like the old school Mr. Garrison. And he would ask you all sorts of crazy stuff, like, you know, if you masturbated and had sex and all sorts. He did all that weird conversation that, you know, that you have with the bishop. And you would have to confess to him, and it was all connected with your therapist. You know, your therapist would know all your issues that you talked about with the branch president, and the missionaries would know why you were there and all your issues. So it was all kind of out there. But the missionaries were mostly just the friendly old people there to give you candy and, you know, to be nice to you. That was really their function.
So I mean, let's go back. If you would confess something to your bishop might share that with your therapist or with other counselors there?
Well, yeah, you don't have, there's a bishop there. I mean, there's a chapel.
Oh, your branch president.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. They would all talk to each other.
Wow. Okay, so we talked about, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, you know, the whole, you know, part of your program and part of getting into a blue shirt from a green shirt was you had to have a meeting with the branch president. You know, they'd do all the typical stuff where you can't pass a sacrament for a while, and, you know, you'd have to work all these things out with your therapist.
Okay, so we talked a little bit about the connection to the church through Butters. What other sort of connections, Eric, have you pointed out with the church?
Oh, I mean, there's a lot of, like, the board of directors, there's a lot of people on there, like LeVar Christensen. That name might not sound super familiar, but he was a Utah congressman, and he co-wrote a bill. I don't remember what it was, but he co-wrote Utah's homosexuality, you know, anti-gay bill. He co-wrote that with Butters, and he was a congressman. He's not anybody now, as far as I know, but he was a super rich Utah lawyer. There's a Jeffrey R. Holland has been there at the Boys Ranch. There's seminary teachers that are called to work there, and they have, you know, they get paid from the Boys Ranch, but I guess his name was Rolf Kerr, and he was the CES, you know, president of the CES, you know, and he used to go out there. I even found a talk by Gordon B. Hinckley, found it online, and he mentioned a letter that he got from the Utah Boys Ranch, and he went on to read it, and it was totally like, it was like a plug for the Boys Ranch, like literally, in this talk by Gordon B. Hinckley. I have it on my website. I link to it. It's crazy. What else? I mean, Deseret News is always publishing stuff about them. Most of the food, like, I'm sure Kate would agree, even it comes from Deseret Industries. Like, almost all the food that we ate was from the DI.
When you say the DI, you're talking about, like, the welfare square food, like the food that comes from the church canneries, right?
Yeah, like the gallon of milk that has a little Deseret label on it.
Right, know? Right.
Like, from the stuff that they give the poor people in the church. Like, we would drink, like, I think that's all we ever drank, really, was that Deseret milk. And the Deseret peanut butter. I remember hating that Deseret peanut butter so much. It was so crappy. And, you know, like, so, like, they get almost all their food from there. If you watch General Conference, you'll see commercials for Westridge Academy in General Conference during General Conference. And like Kate said, every single person that works there is LDS, without question, without any variance. Everyone there is LDS.
So what sort of, you mentioned Jeffrey Holland, what sort of promotion or interaction does he or other general authorities have? And you did mention Westridge Academy. We should probably be clear. It was called the Utah Boys Ranch until about 2005, and they've changed their name to the Westridge Academy, if I have that right.
Well, kind of. When we were there, they called the school part of it Westridge Academy, and your diploma, if you got in your transcripts, would say Westridge Academy. But the actual program and living there and being there, you were part of the ranch. So they used to try and have both going on. The name my high school diploma says Westridge Academy because I graduated high school there. But in 2005 they brought the girls on. So I guess they abandoned that whole name and went with Westridge Academy for everything. So.
Okay, so yeah, the question still sort of holds. You know, what do you know of the cross promotion? How are the general authorities involved in it?
I can imagine that they probably. I mean, this is just me speculating. I don't have any hard evidence, but I can imagine that they are spreading the word about the Boys Ranch for, you know, getting it out to bishops and stake presidents as an option for Mormon families that are, you know, quote unquote, having trouble with their, you know, kids. I think there's a lot of that going on. And I think more of it is about raising money and, you know, getting LDS people to donate, because the big thing that Chris Butters used to say was that, the ranch was built completely debt-free, and so, I mean, it's all, they get a ton of money, like, donated to them, and I'm sure, I don't know how it works, but I'm sure the general authorities have a lot to do with that. And then there's just firesides every Sunday, and sometimes one of them would come out, and there would be, you know, a ton of people showing up. I remember L. Tom Perry came once when I was there. To a fireside, and but you know, I don't know really. I mean, while I was there, it wasn't like such a huge shock to me. Like, I didn't really start thinking about how crazy the whole Mormon part of it was until, you know, I was already, you know, until I was out of that place. Because while I was there, it was just like everyday life. Like, you don't really think, like, this is weird. Like, this is completely 100% Mormon all the time. You know, in your face, like, you don't really think about it because it's just how it is. And all you're thinking about when you're there is getting out and what you got to do to make your life a little easier. So
Eric, let's talk about you for a second. I mean, 3 years seems a long time to be away from your family and away from, your friends, and sort of walked up in this, I don't know.
Yeah.
It sounds like a seminary crossed with a military academy. How did that affect you?
Well, I should clarify. There was about 3 or 4 months of time that I was at home, and then I went back. I went home for the summer. But yeah, it was pretty much like a straight, 3 years that I was there. And it was tough for me because my parents were from California and I didn't have any family in Utah. So I couldn't go home. Like, some boys, you could eventually earn the privilege of going home for the weekend and with your family, and I could never do that. So I was always there, I was there 7 days, a week, and it was pretty tough. I mean, it pretty much destroyed, a family relationship, and it was weird. It took me, It took me a good 3 years from like 18 to like 21 to really, you know, recover and wrap my head around it. And like, because it was just such a crazy experience. I mean, when I started my website, you know, I didn't start it to do any kind of activism or outreach or anything. I had just decided that, you know, I'd finished writing, you know, I was writing a book about it and I'd finished my first draft. And I thought, you know, no one's going to believe this crap. Like, no one is going to believe me. This is crazy. And there was nothing on the internet about it. And so I just decided to start a website that had other stories. And so people, so I could find stories and people could find me and tell, you know, post their stories so that my own story would be believable. Because like some of the stuff that went on there is just, you know, you wouldn't even imagine that, you know, that kind of place exists. And it's, you know, and yet it does, and it's still going strong.
So, Eric, you've alleged abuses. Maybe you can give us an outline of what you think are the worst abuses. I mean, let me frame it this way. Let me play devil's advocate for a minute. You know, some kids are sort of out of control. They need a little bit more structure. They need a little bit more discipline. You know, why isn't this just a way to help the wayward boys?
Well, I mean, it was like I said, it wasn't like they played by their own rules, which is the problem, I think. I think obviously there's kids that need structure, and structure isn't a bad thing for, you know, teenage boys, but they played by their own rules and they would just beat the crap out of kids just for, you know, showing a little attitude. And to some people, I think that they might even think that's okay. But the thing is, these were kids, you know, children, you know, young, mostly young adolescents. Like, I was 15 when I was first there, you know, and I was a lot different when I was 18 when I got out. But, you know, these are young kids, and a lot of them have emotional problems. A lot of them are, you know, I'd say about 50% of them are adopted kids, and so they've got their own issues there. And it's just like a hardcore, violent, traumatic thing. I mean, they would call it being restrained, is what they would call it when you got beat up pretty bad. And I would say maybe I saw one or two out of hundreds of restraints that the kid was actually out of control, or that there was two kids fighting. The rest of the time it was just mostly just for showing attitude. Like, you would get beat up, like you would think, like a mental hospital, or like trained professionals would, like, you know, grab you in the right way and like take you down to the ground and hold you and all that stuff. It wasn't anything like that. It was just like slamming, like just violence. Like, these people were just, that were working there weren't trained in any way. They were mostly young college students, Mormon students, that, you know, were looking for an easy job that worked well with their school schedule. And they would just like beat the crap out of you for showing attitude. And I mean, that's a lot different than treating kids that are like legitimately like out of control. And most of the kids weren't legitimately out of control there. They were out of control at home in ways that their parents, you know. And the other thing about that place that I find problematic is that it's your parents that decide that you go there. There's no kind of appeal process. There's no, like, no doctor saying, okay, yes, this child needs to be locked up. Like, your parents say you need to go, you need to go. And so, like, in my case, when I have like kind of a crazy zealot stepdad who's like hardcore Mormon, who thinks, hears of this place and thinks, oh, this is awesome, I can turn my wicked stepson into a, you know, a missionary, then I'm there and I'm screwed for 3 years. You know, I have no kind of advocate or no appeals process. Like, that's it. I'm done. I'm there. And they'll keep you there as long as they can, you know? And okay. So, I mean, that's not helpful to any kind of problem, I think, in any kind of kid.
Well, you know, Eric, the sort of things you describe, you know, like talking back to adults and cursing and showing attitude, I mean, that's what everybody else was doing too, you know?
Yeah.
You know, so the thing I always worry about when I hear situations like this is, how do you prove you're normal You know, because if you act normal, it seems that that's not tolerated. They want you to go one step beyond that.
Yeah, well, you don't even have the chance to prove that you're normal to anybody. I mean, while you're there, you're trying to pretend like you've seen the light, and there's no arguing with why you're there. You just accept it and say that you're working on it, and you say whatever you can say to get out of there. But it's a huge problem, I think. I'd be more open to places like the Utah Boys Ranch if everyone that went through there at least had to go through some type of process, some type of, you know, fitness evaluation or judicial process or appeal or something. But, you know, there were kids there for anything, for being gay, kids there for just being gay. There's a kid there, a good friend of mine, who was there because he was depressed and his parents were looking on the internet or spoke to an educational consultant and referred them to this place that claims to cure depression, which is, you know, ridiculous. And then there was kids there that were like super, like sexually, like aggressive, like almost like pedophiles, but I don't know if you can be a pedophile and still be a minor. I don't know how that works, but there was like sexually, like some sick sexual stuff going on with some of the kids there. And just most of the kids were just regular, you know. I'm friends with a lot of the people that I was there with because they're just like just regular teenage guys like me, you know. Most of us got along really well.
So, Eric, you've set up the Mormon Gulag site, and that's out at mormongulag.com. And we'll put a link up to it. Have you received any sort of negative feedback or any repercussions for speaking out?
Oh God, yeah, tons. I've got a section on there where I've posted most of the hate mail that I've got. I get a lot of hate mail, and I've gotten a couple threats at lawsuits and stuff like that, but. For the most part, I was really surprised by how many people just said, oh, I'm so glad somebody finally did this. And it kind of changed my whole perspective on things because at first, I was really just there to support, you know, my own story that I was trying to get out there. But, you know, so I've gotten so much positive, you know, support from people that were there, you know, early 90s even, people that were there just a few months ago. Like, it's really, it's quite a lot of people find that website. And it's because there's nothing else out there on the internet, which is why I started it, because there's just no, it was just their representation of who they were. And that was the only side of the story that was being portrayed. And, you know, the best part is, I've gotten a lot of parents that have said, oh, I found your website and, I'm so glad I found it, and I'm not sending my child there. And that's probably the most rewarding for me.
Wow. So Cade, how has your life been changed? Or I guess you wouldn't know how it's been changed, but how has your experience there in the Boys Ranch affected you up till now?
You know, it's raised awareness both in things that I would do as far as communication with my children or other youth, all the way to kind of the way that I may interact with people. You know, sometimes I feel like I'm almost a little manipulative or you know, anxious and untrusting by nature. And obviously I may not be able to attribute that entirely to the ranch, but a great deal of it.
So what would you guys like to see happen? What now?
I'd like personally to see the whole facility be closed down, run, you know, out of business. I'd like to see the people, the most violent of the staff members there, be, you know, held accountable in some way, either, you know, criminally or legally. And I just like to see that place. If, you know, I feel good about a lot of the things that my, you know, the website and the article that I wrote about it have like impacted the way things are, but I really would feel good and I'd feel at peace with this whole thing once they're gone and, you know, out of business, you know,
See, I personally agree with all of that, except for I understand that there is a need for correctional, you know, some sort of correctional something for children often, not oftentimes, but when you're in a situation like that, you may need to go to some sort of a program that's going to help give you some guidance and some positive movement. But I would really like to see some sort of federal regulation or some sort of, you know, state regulation that allows them to be monitored by some other organization.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the kids that need help, there's kids obviously that need help, and they need to be in a facility that doesn't have a financial interest in them being there. And, you know, as much as the state, you know, gets a bad reputation for, you know, look how bad the whole foster care thing is. It's really horrible. But it's worse when you mix this free enterprise with this kind of industry, because I mean, the longer they keep you there, the more money they get, and it just seems so absurd. I don't know why parents even fall for that kind of thing.
Well, I would think if anything, if there's a cautionary tale here, it's for the parents to make sure you realize what you're getting your kids into, you know, to be aware, because I would dare guess that most of them, especially those sending their very young children, would have no idea of what's going on there. So, I mean, it's a cautionary tale for all of us.
Right.
All right. Well, gentlemen, it's been a fascinating talk. It's sort of gut-wrenching to know that it's still there and there's still kids going through this sort of thing. Really eye-opening to see the church's involvement. I do wish you both the best in your recovery and in your endeavors in working towards the relationships you're building with those who've come out of the Boys Ranch.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. And as always, well, you can head over to the website at mormongulag.com, or you can check us out at our website. And as always, the discussion continues there at mormonexpression.com. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.